And they all lived happily ever after. Every one of us here has heard that saying before. It is a standard ending to a more of a love story type of fairy tale where, generally speaking, the bad guys are defeated. The sun is shining brightly. The flowers are blooming. The animals are dancing in unison. And the hero and the heroine walk hand in hand into the sunset as small, colorful birds drop rose petals at their feet. That's kind of the way it works, isn't it? Now, there's a reason they're called fairy tales. First of all, in real life, nothing is ever that tidy, and animals never dance in groups. Everybody knows that. So it is a fairy tale. Now, the conclusion of the book of Ruth may be the closest thing we have in real life to a fairy tale type of ending. I mean, we really don't have a lot of information here, but it is interesting to say the least. Now, to be fair, the ending of Ruth, verses 13 through 22, is really more like a snapshot of the best of results, not a close look at everything that followed. This isn't maybe typical of the entirety of their life, but really an overlook, a quick overlook of how this ended. More perhaps like the Facebook version of Ruth's My Story. This is what it would look like. It is, however, the conclusion that the author intended from the beginning. The more evident purpose of God in the circumstances of Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz, which is the providence that made certain the genealogy that led straight to King David. And if the general assumption is indeed true that Samuel is the author of Ruth, no one really knows for sure. But if that's the case, then we can certainly better understand his purpose in writing it or making sure it was written. He was the man God sent to anoint David to the throne as a ruddy-faced boy. And he was the man not all that far removed from the participants in the story itself. He is considered the last of the judges of Israel. And Ruth may have been written, at least it's assumed so, around the time of the judge Gideon. So let's go ahead and read the conclusion of the matter in Ruth 4, verses 13 through 22. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went under her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And the women said unto Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, which has not left you this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he will be unto you a restorer of your life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, which loves you, which is better to you than seven sons, has borne him." And Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became nurse unto it. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi." And they called his name Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nashon, and Nashon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. Later on, we're going to go through the genealogy in Matthew, and I'm going to slaughter many of the names there. This was a much easier genealogy. It'd be easier to read through it slowly and pronounce every name individually, but no, I'm going to kill him. So let's note in verse 13 that Ruth is called the wife of Boaz. She is either referred to in this book as Ruth, and that's generally when it's saying, "And Ruth said to Naomi," or "Ruth said to..." And when she's referred to in general, it's always as Ruth the Moabitess. But she will no longer be known in Israel by her past. She is no longer Ruth the Moabitess, but her present. Now his people, which she said before when they left Moab to go into Israel, into Bethlehem, she said, "Your people will be my people, your God my God." Now Boaz's people or her people and his God, her God. And note in verse 13 that it says, the Lord gave her conception to bear a son. Because this story in all of its parts is his story. It's about what he's doing. To get where we are at the end of Ruth and on to eventually King David could never be left to chance events that are frail and uncertain. Listen, the famine that began this whole scenario and the eventful decision to leave for Moab had to happen before Mahlon had already married in Bethlehem. So he couldn't be too old and have already taken a wife. And it had to happen while Ruth was still too young to wed in Moab. Elimelech had to travel 1,800 miles and settle near Ruth's family somewhere. In the entirety of the land of Moab, he had to come across that particular family. Mahlon and Chilion had to either be then unable to produce children, because even if his brother had produced, there'd be no need for an heir. And so Mahlon and Chilion had to either be unable to produce children or both of them simply died before children were produced and after Elimelech's death. It may have been that we started out by learning that they were sickly boys. They're named because of their infirmities. And so it may be that they were unable to produce. May also be, looking at verse 13, that the Lord simply withheld children. I don't know. And then that famine had to end and prosperity had to return at the right time for Naomi to receive word from home that things were good there now. And before the scenario with the three widows all living together took a wrong turn in Moab. I mean, on top of this, Naomi had to be the kind of woman that inclined her daughter-in-laws to want to remain with her and not leave. They weren't bound by law to live with her. In fact, she says to them, go home, because if you go home, your parents will help you find another husband. And so they could have left immediately upon the death of their husbands, and yet they loved her, both of them, and wanted to stay with her. But in the end, only one could actually return with her. And as it turns out, one goes back and one continues on. As well, Boaz, who is wealthy and mature, has to be unmarried and available. To which we add the legal issues concerning the kinsman redeemer, with Boaz in the second chair, not the first chair, to be able to act in order to get Ruth in the first place. None of which we would know anything about were it not for the author of this book. But let me tell you something. Random events subject to chance cannot produce precise and exacting results. But God can. That's what we've been seeing through this whole book. Results that we can rejoice over as we come to the end of Ruth. So let's go back to the text, verse 14. Now, exactly what's taking place in these verses is hard to sort out, really. I mean, there are cultural issues here that we don't have much insight into. Ruth, in fact, is not even mentioned by name after verse 13. This book begins and ends with Naomi. But the details here are light and sketchy. It appears, this is the best we can discern from these verses, that after Ruth gave birth, a group of unnamed women, they're called Naomi's neighbors, probably the women of her age, closest to her in relationship, go to the house of Boaz, where the baby has been born, and they bring the baby from the house of Boaz to the house of Naomi. It would appear, at least, that this is a ceremony of some sorts that's connected to Redeemer law. Again, we don't know for sure. But the ceremony, if that's what it is, and I believe it is, begins with the declaration that God is the source of this benevolent and kind ending. And the woman said unto Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel." This is not good luck or the good thoughts of all of your friends. And we've all, if you're on Facebook, your Facebook page will say it's so-and-so's birthday. Sometimes it'll say, "Why don't you wish Bob good thoughts or send Bob good thoughts?" And then I don't know how to do that because I've sat there and tried to send good thoughts to Bob and Bob didn't reply. How do you send good thoughts? Well, listen, this isn't good luck or the good thoughts of people. People will say when they go to want to pray for you, they'll say, "I'll pray good thoughts for you. I'll think good thoughts for you this week." I don't think that has any bearing whatsoever on how my week is going to go. Appreciate the fact that you care about me and you want to say something about me as your week goes on, but there's no power in your good thoughts. And there's no power in chance. God alone must be the first and ultimate focus of our gratitude. God alone is the source of what is occurring here and what occurs in our life. It is He that has orchestrated every point and detail. He did not abandon Naomi even when she came home empty. That's just all she could see. That's all she could know. Was it wrong for her to feel that way? It was natural for her to feel that way. It was normal for her to feel that way. But what we think or how we feel has no effect on what God is actually doing. It's why your good thoughts can't do anything when you're thinking them. It's why having a bad dream about something can't make it happen. Listen, every time somebody says to you, "I had a bad dream about this deal and it came to pass," and I'll say, "Was that the only bad dream you've ever had?" "Well, no, I've had a lot of bad dreams. How many of those came to pass?" "Well, none of the other ones." And so, really, that's a roll in the dice, isn't it? You really think your dream had something to do with how things turned out? It has nothing to do with it. None of that changes or alters or moves whatever God Himself is doing. And quite frankly, it's in not knowing what's going on that faith resides. Because it's only there that we can trust. Romans 8:24 says, "A hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man sees, why does he yet hope?" Think about Thomas. Thomas says, "I won't believe unless I can stick my fingers in his side where the spear went." And the Lord said, "Thomas, more blessed are those who believe who have not seen." Why would we hope? If God comes down and He says, of course, we only want Him to say things we really want to happen, right? If the Lord should come down and He should say, "Listen, I know things are really grim right now, but here's what I'm going to do." And then you let you, "Oh, okay." He actually gives you the vision. You see it all happening. It's all laid out. Now you're all good. Where's faith in that? But He also might say, "Here's what I'm going to do." And you go, "Ooh, truck's going to follow me. I'm not sure I like that vision." I mean, really, there's a lot to be said for not knowing. But faith resides in not knowing, not in knowledge. Verse 15 is a declaration of the realization of God's blessing through the remainder of Naomi's life. He says, this child, this son, will restore the vitality of life to you that has been lost. She lost a husband. She lost two sons. Ruth can be a wonderful daughter-in-law, whom she can love deeply, but she is not a child, is she? So God brings that life back into her life. kind of like breathing new life into damaged lungs, so to speak. And he says he will be a nourisher of your old age. Literally, he will feed your gray hairs when you get old. You'll make sure you're taken care of, Naomi. You'll be well fed and cared for, even when you can no longer care for yourself. And because God has blessed her with Ruth as a daughter-in-law, it says, who loves her and is better to her than seven sons. By the way, seven sons is the idealized number of sons in Israel to secure one's future. It was always considered that if you had seven sons, at least one of them would make sure you were taken care of in your old age. If you had six, you might make it, you might not. And yet Ruth, she'll never use this child for her own benefit. She'll never come back and say, that's really my child. This stuff is really my stuff. She won't use that child to manipulate or to steal or to deceive, but only to love Naomi. She'll always see that son as the child that God gave to Naomi. Verse 16, Naomi, who will become, in essence, foster mother. Now, we don't understand how this arrangement works either. I'm telling you a lot of stuff, and I'm telling you absolutely nothing. Because there's more stuff in these verses than we know anything about. But that word in verse 16, Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became nurse, Ammon, that's in essence what it means. It is most probable, let's put it that way, that Ruth weaned this child and Naomi raised him. That he was actually raised in Naomi's home. He is legally of Elimelech's household, not the household of Boaz. That word nurse refers to a legal guardian or a foster or one designated to care for him. That's what the word means. This isn't grandma visiting or babysitting through the week. The restoration or redemption in Naomi comes with responsibility to the child. She is at least apparently the grandmother raising the grandson as a son. It's a situation probably everybody here has seen at one time or another or done. Carol Jean has a cousin who became her aunt, adopted by her grandmother. She became Carol Jean's aunt. Listen, culture only affects how the details play out. But grandparents raising children happens all the time. Now, you can still say grandma and grandpa, but who are you looking to for everything you need every day? They are, in essence, your mother and your father. So if that's the case here, and I tend to believe that it is, the best that we can see, then Ruth is still involved and will be involved. She's not going to be involved in the everyday upbringing of this child. Now, I think maybe, again, the women are acting as the bridge between Naomi and Ruth. There's this ceremony taking place that Ruth has a baby, but it's not for Ruth. And it's not for Boaz, it's for Naomi. And so they stay separate in their individual homes, and the women bring the baby from the home of Ruth to the home of Naomi as a part of that bridging of the gap. But they not only bring the child, they also name him, so that neither one has the responsibility to name the child. It's not Ruth's, and as of yet, until it's brought to Naomi, it's not Naomi's. And so the women name the child. They name him Obed. Some think that that's a shortened version of Obadiah, which means servant of the Lord, and that may well be, but Obed by itself means one who works or serves. And Obed then has become, in essence, the Goel of Naomi, her redeemer, servant, provider in her home as her son. But there can be no doubt that he will first and foremost be loved. In other words, Ruth didn't have a servant for Naomi. She had a son. He's going to come in and serve because he loves her. Not because he was created to be an in-home servant of some kind. Now, as we come to the very end of verse 17 and on to 22, we need to hear the voice of someone, perhaps Samuel, who has been writing this story, I believe, for this ending. I think everything in this entire book has been for verse 17, right there. This is not, it would be a grave mistake to see this as some sort of anticlimactic genealogy at the end of the book. So you get down here and you go, oh yeah, so-and-so begat, so-and-so begat, they were begatting all the time. This is actually the climactic point of the whole story. I think if he were reading this story or telling someone orally about this story, that we might find him coming to this part and his voice would be rising in tone. Listen. He's gone through this whole thing. The famine, and they leave to go to Moab, and the boys marry women there, and they die, and the father dies. He goes through this whole story, and he gets down here. He says, listen, this whole thing I've been telling you about, this is so cool. You need to pay attention right here. This is the end of it right here. This is Obed, father of Jesse, father of David. That's exciting news, folks. That's exciting news. All of that. So everybody can see what God was doing to bring this to pass. All of that. Here's David. Look at here. Then he expands his point in verses 18 through 22, beginning with Perez, son of Judah, and Tamar. The family line from which Bethlehem Judeans come from. He draws a line through time, hitting the key high points all the way to David. How gracious of God to allow us to see even a minute portion of his kind hand of providence. If this didn't exist, we never heard of Ruth. We knew nothing of Boaz. Boaz's name would probably show up in a genealogy somewhere, but who's Boaz? Just another name that's a heck of a lot easier to pronounce than all those other names. I'd take a whole list of genealogies where everybody was named like Boaz or Bob or Jim or something. That'd be a lot easier. But that's not what it is it? God says, listen, every once in a while, I'm gonna throw something out there for you so that you're not ignorant of the fact that I'm the one that's moving history, not history telling me what to do. It belongs to me. All of this took place in the lives of ordinary people. So that could happen. And here we see God is that author. Ordinary people in uncertainty and loss and tragedy to an extraordinary end. Listen, you sat down and you read through the book of Ruth. Well, you have. And maybe you didn't do it personally, but you heard it from me. We can draw insight from Naomi and Ruth and Boaz from the things they've done in their life, right? It's there in the story. We can learn from them. We can see the benefits of obedience and that of keeping our ledgers clear in the things that we do. So we're not looking over our back throughout our future, wondering when the next shoe is going to drop. We can draw strength to sustain us in time of hardships by looking back and seeing how God dealt with Naomi and Ruth and all that loss and tragedy. All those, there's all kinds of stuff we can glean from this story that's good stuff. And I hope, at least in some way, that we did that as we walked through this book. I hope we did. However, if we don't see the works of God in all of this, then we've missed the whole point. Especially from where we sit in the context of time. Because the author of Ruth could only see as far forward as David. Turn to Matthew chapter 1. And just pretend like I'm saying everything exactly the way it should be said. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 17. It's a genealogy, by the way, that precedes the book of the birth, or the birth of Jesus in the book of Matthew. This is what Ruth's genealogy didn't know. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judas and his brethren. And Judas begat Phares and Zerah of Tamar, and Phares begat Esram, and Esram begat Aram, and Aram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Naasan, and Naasan begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab, and Boaz begat Obed of Ruth, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David the king. Far as it goes, doesn't it? And David the king begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. And Solomon begat Rehoboam, and Rehoboam begat Abiah, and Abiah begat Asa. And Asa begat Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat begat Joram, and Joram begat Ozias. And Ozias begat Jotham, and Jotham begat Achaz, and Achaz begat Ezekias, and Ezekias begat Manasseh. And Manasseh begat Amon, and Amon begat Josiah. And Josiah begat Jeconiah and his brethren about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begat Salathiel, and Salathiel begat Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel begat Abiah, that guy's name, and Abiah begat Eliakim, and Eliakim begat Azor, and Azor begat Sadok, and Sadok begat Achim, and Achim begat Eliud, and Eliud begat Eleazar, and Eleazar begat Mathan, and Mathan begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David until the carrying away into Babylon are 14 generations, and from the carrying away into Babylon unto Christ are 14 generations. I need a drink of water. I'm so glad we're not named this way. A biblical genealogy from Abraham all the way through to Mary, the mother of Jesus. What the author of Ruth could only leave off at David, and had the author lived on into the life of Solomon, may have included that. Would certainly seem like you would include the next king. So the idea is that this was written before David was actually made king, or shortly thereafter, but before Solomon. Again, but let me sum. I can't tell you why, but Matthew includes five women, and it's not a common practice in biblical genealogies because family lines run through men. It's through the names, the family names, or through the husbands. It's not to exclude the women. It's just that that's the way genealogies work. We're messing that up to some degree. I'm glad in some ways, at least nowadays, women are using their original name like second and their married name last. At least you're keeping that line open for future generations to trace their heritage back. But generally speaking, it runs through the husband. But by inspiration, Matthew includes Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, because she's called Uriah's wife, and Mary. Four of whom come with some sort of either moral or cultural issue, except Mary, the fifth, who is lauded as a faithful servant of God from her youth. Now, I'm very certain this isn't done because Matthew was an early feminist supporter. This has nothing to do with any of that whatsoever. There's no agenda in that sense here at all. But only perhaps, and I mean perhaps only, it's to remind us, as in Ruth, that God's choices do not conform to any of man's expectations. Most clearly revealed is that true in the details of the life of Jesus. Messiah has come into the world. The Messiah, the very one we've been looking forward to for, well, you can actually go all the way back to Genesis, looking forward to that Redeemer that's coming, the one that's going to fatally bruise the head of Satan and right on down the line. And when he shows up, they say, he's from Nazareth? What good comes out of Nazareth? He's from Cleveland? What? From Detroit? They don't even have a football team. Why would he come out of there? I mean, wouldn't you expect, if you were just human, to look back and see some sort of royal lineage of some kind? I mean, there's David there. But, man, there's a lot of, what, a harlot and a deceiver and a woman who committed adultery? They're all included in that line, right? I mean, part of the reason they didn't receive Jesus, he didn't grow up and then go seek out the Pharisees except to correct their theology when he was only 13 or 12. He didn't come find them so he could reveal himself to them and say, hey, I'm your leader. You guys have been doing a great job here, by the way. Oh, no, he goes and says, you're snakes in the grass. You're whitewashed sepulchers. How could this be the Messiah? God's choices, they're not what you think they are. We should all know that because he saved us. Anybody here in this room worth saving? Look at your life. Look at who you are. Look at who you've been. I can look back and there's no reason the Lord should have pulled me out of the pit. I was sleeping in every night and walking in every day. We are reminded by Paul in 1 Corinthians 1 that God's choices leave no room for the flesh to glory in his presence. That's the reminder. It says, if we are to glory, we must glory in God alone, for he is the whole point of the story. He doesn't choose very many noble, very many mighty, but he chooses those nobody else would ever choose. When I became a believer, I had guys that spent the whole first year where I worked as a believer waiting for me to go back to being the guy I was, because they thought there's no way this clown is going to continue to move forward in this way. Yeah, we know who you are, Greg. Nice facade for a while. But what God does, he does. And it just goes beyond anything that any reason that we can imagine. But he's making a declaration by his choices. I don't need you. I don't need who you are. I don't need what you do. I don't care how smart you are, how fast you run, how well you sing, how well you paint, write, compose, how good you are in the neighborhood, how much money you give to charity. I take the widow with the mites. Yeah. Throw everything you got in the pot. Leave your mother and father and come follow me. Fishermen, bunch of fishermen. You know what? Fishermen smell like fish. Not guys I'm choosing to hang around. I don't even like fish. He goes down and he chooses fishermen. Chooses a tax collector. Are you kidding me? The despised, most despised man in the land. He doesn't choose Paul till he chooses him as one chosen out of time. Paul's the only real scholar in the group as far as theological training. Luke has Luke has an education. He's a well-educated man. He's a historian, but that's two guys. When we look back over the book of Ruth, we need to see what God did to bring about his end. And that didn't end with David. And it ran all the way straight through to Jesus. And it didn't end with Jesus. It's going to go all the way end to the fact that he's coming back again. And we are now a part of that family genealogy. We're family now. An innumerable host of people that God has chosen. None of us worth a penny, but with Christ, we have all the value there ever was to have that ever existed. Amen. Grateful for Ruth. We are the evidence of his kind providence and now just instruments in his mighty hands. Let's bow for prayer.